New York City is the most linguistically diverse city in the history of the world. Walk along Roosevelt Avenue in Queens, and you might hear a handful of the hundreds of languages that are spoken along that street and in New York City. It seems like being a linguist in New York City would feel like a kid in a candy store. But it's also a reminder of a troubling trend. Over half of the world's 7,000 languages are expected to disappear during the next century. And linguists and language keepers the world over are in a race to document, map, and preserve these endangered languages. Dr. Ross Perlin is one such linguist. His book, Language City, A Fight to Preserve Endangered Mother Tongues in New York, is a portrait of contemporary New York City through six speakers of little-known and overlooked languages. And he joins us today from his home in New York City. Ross, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
I never even considered that New York City might be such a fascinating linguistic story. In fact, as you write, the most linguistically diverse city in the history of the world. That's quite a statement.
When people think about endangered languages, smaller languages, indigenous languages, they often think of a distant mountain or a far-off island somewhere, and that's certainly true historically. But now, with people moving all over the globe, with urbanization happening everywhere, there are actually speakers of endangered languages right next door for many of us. And, you know, New York has always been a very diverse place. It's a city that is known for immigration. But what's happened in the last few decades is just, you know, something extraordinary. And New York is not alone. It's happening in other cities where speakers of languages from all over the globe, and indeed the last speakers of endangered languages in some cases, are now coming to these shores.
As a travel writer and somebody who just... My mission is to inspire and equip Americans to, you know, venture beyond Orlando. I want them to have some culture shock. You can just stay in New York City if you don't want to take the time and money to fly around the world. And you can really do an amazing job of introducing yourself to much of the world.
I think that's exactly the way to see it. You know, so many people, when they come to New York, of course, they're thinking about Rockefeller Center, the Empire State Building, the great museums, and so on. But how many make it out to a place like Queens, which is the epicenter of this linguistic diversity, because people have come there from all over the world? You can experience all these languages and cultures within just a few blocks of each other.
Well, take us on a walk down Roosevelt Avenue in Queens. As a linguist, I could walk down it and I might just see, you know, interesting shops and a lot of diversity in the people that are around me. But what would you see as a linguist?
The lens of language, I think, is a special one, because especially oral language, you know, most languages historically have been oral, have not had writing systems. That's been a pretty recent thing in language for just a smaller number of languages. You know, so you can, you know, you look at the signs. There's a lot that the signs will tell you for sure. I mean, you're walking along, you know, Roosevelt Avenue is one of these great streets that's just, you know, teeming with life and tons of restaurants. Of course, you know, from the signs, you can tell, let's say, you know, first, you're probably in this sort of South Asian world, which people might think from the outside, okay, this is Indian. These are Indian restaurants. But actually, look a little more closely, and we're actually talking about a lot of people from Pakistan and Bangladesh and Nepal. And then actually, you listen a little more closely, you'd find that's Tibetan, or that's Newari, or that's, you know, which is the mother tongue of Kathmandu, or, you know, there's dozens and dozens of languages just from Nepal that are spoken there. And there are institutions, little, hometown associations, little stores, little restaurants that actually represent all those cultures. And if you listen to what people are actually speaking, oh, they're from that part of the Himalaya, they're from that part of the plains area. And so actually, you know, it becomes hundreds of languages. And you walk a little bit further and you're actually in a sort of microcosm of Latin America.
Now, Ross, a couple things you mentioned. First of all, you used the word mother tongue. The subtitle of your book, Language City, The Fight to Preserve Endangered Mother Tongues in New York. What is a mother tongue?
Well, you know, it's interesting. In different languages, people refer to it in different ways. In English, we say mother tongue usually. In Tibetan, for instance, they say palke, which means father tongue. But in either case, what we're talking about is, you know, the sort of native language that you hear from your family at home, the first language often. And, you know, so many people in a place like New York are multilingual. Half of all New Yorkers speak a language other than English at home. And many speak 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 languages routinely. But the mother tongue is something special. And that's often the one that's kind of most endangered,
okay,
right? It's not the one that's in school or in official
right.
business.
As a linguist, that's probably the fertile soil for you to dig into.
Well, it represents the vast majority of the world's 7,000 languages, you know, only a few hundred of which are really official. And these are the languages which are least documented, that we know the least about and have a lot of the greatest richness.
So now you write in your book, never before have cities like New York been so linguistically various, and they may never be again. But this new hyperdiversity has hardly been mapped, let alone understood or supported. This is what a linguist does, right? Why does this matter, and what is mapping these languages, and what's the value of understanding them?
The paradox is that just as all these languages are arriving in cities like New York, and I should also say Los Angeles, Chicago, San Francisco, and so on, they're also in danger of disappearing. They're endangered back home. They're also, you know, people are feeling a massive pressure to shift not only to English, but to Spanish or to Mandarin or other large languages. So, you know, linguists do all kinds of things, and unfortunately, only a small portion actually focus on endangered languages. But those of us who do, we create dictionaries, we create recordings of languages which haven't been recorded, we document their grammar. And mapping, quite literally, is something we've done here in New York, where we've created a language map showing over 700 of these mother tongues as spoken all around the metropolitan area, including, you know, the wider metro region.
So the map is literally locating where these languages are spoken.
Yes, focused on significant sites, restaurants, community centers, churches, mosques. And it's actually an incredible guide, I think, for people who want to just go through New York. It's freely available, languagemap.nyc.
I would love to see that. Next time I'm in New York, I'm going to get my hands on it. I'll contact you. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're joined by Dr. Ross Perlin. We're looking at the language landscape of New York City. Ross's book is Language City, and it explores the past, present, and future of the most linguistically diverse city in history. Ross is a linguist, author, translator who teaches at Columbia. He's written for The New York Times, The Guardian, Harper's, and more. You can find out more about Ross and his work at rossperlin.com. That's spelled P-E-R-L-I-N. Now, Ross, in your book, you talk about New York, and originally, of course, it was New Amsterdam. What languages would we have heard way back in those days? Would it have also been a collection of languages?
So one thing that my book Language City tries to do is tell a linguistic history of the city, which, you know, every city is multilingual in different ways, and language is a deeper lens. That's part of what I'm arguing than just saying, oh, they're from such and such country or so on. Many of these countries didn't exist in the time of, say, New Amsterdam. But what's special about New Amsterdam and later New York is that, you know, this was founded as a Dutch colony, right? Different from the English colonies around it, which were pretty much at that time kind of English only, as well as the Native American languages that they were encountering. But it was founded as a Dutch colony that was an entrepot of peoples, a melting pot already, a mix such that there were reported to be 18 languages spoken there just within the first few years by about 400 people. And these were European languages, African languages brought by enslaved Africans, as well as Native American languages. So that was already the template from the very beginning in New Amsterdam.
You, in your book, I just think it's interesting, you follow six people who each speak an endangered language in New York City. And they are your gateway to understanding this diversity. For instance, a woman named Karen teaches Lenape, the indigenous language of New York before the white people came. You told a kind of a funny story about how she got a parking ticket in what should be her homeland. And she was just coming into town to working so hard for her mission, which is to keep that language alive.
Lenape is a language which is down to one native speaker at this point. And, you know, this was the native language of the whole New York area, stretching up pretty far even into New Jersey, Pennsylvania. Now there's, as I say, one native speaker in her 80s who's in Canada, but then there's a group of people who are Lenape people, but who have been learning the language as a second language and who are trying to revive it. Karen was one of them. She passed away last year. But she would come down here, you know, not for pay or anything like that. She would come down a 10-hour trip and teach the language, bring the language back to its homeland, essentially. And she would teach it here at the Endangered Language Alliance. Indeed, one day she got a parking ticket for being here, just for bringing her language here on, you know, what was her people's land. But she was an extraordinary person. And it's kind of a story of how languages are being revitalized, especially Native American languages. But languages all over are actually, in the teeth of this endangerment situation, actually being revitalized in some extraordinary ways as well.
So when you say native speaker, we're not referring to Native American. It's just a person who has spoken it from birth, right? And I would think in the future, for all these languages that are endangered, you'll lose the native speakers, but you'll still have revivalists that keep it alive. And it's your mission as a linguist is to not lose the value of that language, even though there's no more native speakers of that language.
It could be that languages will survive through the revivalists and through online archives, which we're helping to build, and who knows, AI, other technologies. You know, there are also now cases showing that there can be sort of new native speakers, and some languages now, you know, are having native speakers for the first time in a century, where the parent has taught themselves as a revivalist, and then they teach their kids, and
wow,
a sort of new native speaker comes into being. So it is possible for, you know, languages to come back with enough
so you can have like
extraordinary
a phoenix
will.
Come rise up from
yes.
nothing.
Yeah.
Rasmina is one of the characters that you profile.
Rasmina is somebody I've worked with for a number of years now on her language, which is called Seke, and is spoken in Nepal, in five villages of Nepal, that is, by a total of about 700 people. Now, it's inside Nepal, but it's very close to the Tibetan border. The people are Tibetan Buddhist. The language is actually historically closer to Tibetan, but quite distinct from it. So that language, Seke, you know, had never been written down, had never really been documented, and now about 200 of those 700 speakers have come to New York and are living in just a few buildings here. So, you know, she's pretty much the youngest speaker of that language in her early 20s and is devoted to finding a way to carry it on, at least document it and share it with the world.
Now, if I saw these people, I'd think, oh, there's a couple hundred Nepalese people speaking Nepali. But of course, if you're Nepalese, you'd know that was a unique language, Seke. They must find some practical value, or they just must find some comfort in living in the same neighborhood. What is the gravitational kind of pull of this common language for people so far from where they were raised?
A language is just so fundamental to cultural life, but also just to feel a feeling of home and being able to be yourself. So, you know, there you could think of almost concentric circles, or, you know, ways that people kind of gather and settle in a city like New York, which we've tried to trace through this mapping and through the book, such that the Seke speakers have been able to sort of carve out their own couple of buildings, which are not 100% Seke, but they also have neighbors who speak, who are more just Nepali speakers or Tibetan speakers, also some who are from Jamaica or from Pakistan or other places. But within their very tight-knit community, they can support each other in all kinds of ways. You know, it's almost like an extended family, basically. And with their many languages, they can sort of live among Nepalis and Tibetans and, of course, speak English in their jobs and other things, too.
Another interesting person you wrote about was Ibrahima.
Ibrahima is from Guinea in West Africa. Again, super multilingual, speaker of a language called Maninka, but also learning, you know, French and Arabic as a Muslim, French because it was the colonial language there and still used in school, speaks, you know, beautiful English as well. But, you know, his project now for the last many years has been on a writing system called Unko, which is one of the most successful sort of new writing systems in the world, pioneered in the 1940s in Guinea to unite speakers of a whole group of languages in West Africa called the Manding languages. And the writing system is really spreading. It works very well for these languages. It's sort of extraordinary looking in its design. And here is Ibrahima now with many thousands of speakers of these languages who've come to especially Harlem and the Bronx trying to sort of bring this new way of writing.
What an eye-opener, all of this, just to look at one city and its linguistic diversity. Ross Perlin's joining us on Travel with Rick Steves from his office at the Endangered Language Alliance in Manhattan. They're mapping the linguistic diversity of New York City and trying to preserve the world's most endangered languages. Their website is elaalliance.org, and you can see their work at languagemap.nyc. Ross has also just released his book, Language City, The Fight to Preserve Endangered Mother Tongues in New York. It focuses on the stories of six speakers of little-known languages. You'll find web links to all of that in the notes for this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Ross, tell us about the Endangered Language Alliance.
The Endangered Language Alliance was founded in 2010 by linguists working with a poet and a whole range of New Yorkers who realized that living in the most, you know, linguistically diverse city probably in the history of the world, there was something that should be done about that, that it was an extraordinary opportunity for linguists and language activists, ordinary New Yorkers, teachers, students, anybody interested, to record those languages, to create a gathering place for people who wanted to do projects around their languages. And we've now recorded speakers of over 100 different languages from all over. We've done this mapping project. We do education projects. We have all kinds of public events. It's just, as far as we know, still the only organization devoted to urban linguistic diversity that just says New York is a place that's open to and rich with these languages. And, you know, they may be less tangible, perhaps, than, say, all of the restaurants and all these other things, but they're no less a part of the city's extraordinary cultural landscape.
Russ, if you could wave a magic wand and shape the future linguistically of New York City, what would it look like? What does healthy multilingualism look like?
Healthy multilingualism is such a good term, and it's really the way we need to be thinking. Nobody denies that, you know, English is absolutely the lingua franca of the city and is, you know, an essential part of living in the city, as in the U.S. And I should say the many Englishes, because really every variety of English is also spoken here. That includes, you know, Singapore English, Indian English, you know, the various English Creoles of the Caribbean, so all the many Englishes. But also that there should be room for these other 700 plus languages here, that there should be language access for city services such that people can get interpretation in courts and hospitals and be able to sort of do the essential things they need to do in the language that they're most comfortable in, especially where it's most essential for their lives. Also a place for people to sort of revive and explore and hold on to and transmit their languages and learn languages. I mean, that's an incredible opportunity that, you know, as somebody coming to New York or living in New York, you can find someone here who speaks just about, you know, any language, certainly all the larger languages and many smaller ones.
But what do you say to a skeptic who just feels, as a matter of practicality, you can't have everything printed in every language and you can't, you know, it just all falls apart. And immigrant family could be actually at a disadvantage if they don't embrace the lingua franca of a society. How can it be practical? Because I got to say, I've always thought it's just practical to have one language. But of course, it has to be more thoughtful than that.
I think some people overestimate the, you know, one language to rule them all, because first of all, that would, you know, whose language would that be? Everybody kind of imagines it would be their language, but how would we feel if suddenly the official language became Mandarin Chinese or Spanish, you know, for a native English speaker? So, and of course, the dream of Esperanto was to find some sort of middle ground for everybody. But the reality is we're coming from so many different backgrounds, and those should all be kind of valued and find a place. But, you know, the practical side certainly is, you know, that there should be a lingua franca. It's just not to impose that as a sort of mother tongue. And nobody's suggesting that there should be translations of every sign into 700 plus languages, which obviously there's just not enough space on any sign to do that. So, you know, it's where there's a need, where there's a desire. And it's less, it's at least from where I'm coming from, about a sort of legalistic, like, okay, we need to do this or that, but about seeing it not as a burden, but as a sort of wealth, actually, and that we can learn from these languages with the knowledge that they have, the cultural richness, that there's an incredible wealth here that we can learn from. You know, there are all kinds of free resources in the city for people to learn English, and that's very important. But also there should be resources and abilities for people to learn, you know, other languages and to maintain those as well. So as not to let this richness just run through our fingers, but to actually celebrate it and enjoy it and use it.
It seems kind of fundamental to raise an awareness that multilingualism is not a burden, but it's actually a reflection of the wealth and the richness of the diversity on this planet and how to celebrate it. Dr. Russ Perlin, best wishes with your mission with the Endangered Language Alliance, and thanks for writing Language City, the fight to preserve endangered mother tongues in New York.
Thank you so much, Rick.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton, Kaz Murrah-Hall, and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court upload the shows to our website. Sheila Gerzoff handles affiliate promotions, and our theme music is by Jerry Frank. Look at Rick's checklist for what to pack in your suitcase and share tips with fellow travelers. It's part of our online travel forum that you'll find at ricksteves.com. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.